This is Abundance. Allred, your host. Welcome to my expression of thanks for the bounty of this universe, the amazing wealth of words written by talented authors from across the world. I'm so thankful to share these words this time, this day with you. On Abundance, we discuss topics from my gratitude list I call 1001 Thanks. Today, number 848, teamwork is our focus. Dane Allred's partly colored dream coat. Too much money. Is there such a thing as too much money? I don't think I want to be tempted by the lure of riches, and as a teacher, I probably never will be. It's been a good career for me, and I love what I do, even if I will never be rich from my profession. But there are times I think I am overcompensated, and these usually involve some of my other activities. I shot a commercial on Wednesday where I was paid $500 to model my overweight, pasty white back. It's a commercial for a patch, and they wanted a picture of my back, so I had my wife take one with my camera phone, and I emailed it to the client. It's a strange thing to have someone else want to display your back for their product, and I don't know if I'm comfortable with this kind of exposure, pun intended. I definitely was overcompensated. But these are the kinds of special occurrences in my life that make me wonder about the universe. I love the abundance I see everywhere, and getting paid this kind of money for bearing my back is a strange way to celebrate abundance. Don't get me wrong, I won't turn down the money, it's just that I think it's ludicrous to get that kind of money for one day's work, especially when I consider some people in the world never make that much in a year, let alone in one day. But there definitely is something strange about getting paid to make a commercial about a pain patch. But stranger things have happened, and I hope this isn't the last time I get a chance to do something different. I did get overpaid one time when an advertising agency saved a bunch of money by filming in Utah. This commercial was supposed to be about how MCI was the telephone company of the future. Somehow, it had something to do with driving the golden spike. So when the company budgeted $3 million to shoot it, they had quite a bit left over. Since the Golden Spike Monument is a national park, there was no cost to use the site. When all was said and done, the extra money had to be spent. You know how that works. If you don't spend the budget you're given, then your budget will be reduced next time. It really shouldn't be this way, but it is one of the problems of business. I had already been paid too much to pose at the top of a telegraph pole, peering off into the future, seeing what a great company MCI would become. I got $200 for spending 2 days pretending to be building the first transcontinental railroad. The workers who slaved away, risked their lives doing it for real, only got $35 a month. Yes, that was many years ago, but it still doesn't make it right. Since there was extra money, the company shooting the commercial called me up and asked if I would like to be bumped up to a featured extra. They sent me a check for $3,000, and all I had to do was sign a paper. Like I said before, it's overcompensation. Maybe not the way you're used to defining it, but who turns it down when it's offered? I really only have two rules that apply to almost all situations. Number one is, they will take your money. I have found that this is true in most cases, even when a deadline is involved. I was admitted to a master's program at a major university 9 months after the deadline, and I only had to pay a late fee. I think it was $50. Rule number two does have some qualifications, but it is, I'll take their money. There are some things I wouldn't do for money, but we don't need to list those here today. Let's just say, if it's not immoral or illegal, I will probably take money to do it. Lift sheetrock over my head and hold it while an old guy tries to screw it in? No problem. Castrate pigs? Also, no problem. Risk my life cutting trees with chainsaws miles from civilization? Again, no problem. I've even been paid to say words I really don't want my daughters to hear, but they are understanding, as long as I'm playing a character. I don't think you could pay me to swear at them. I've done that without pay, and I'm usually sorry after. That being said, I know there are people in the world paid to do bad things, and I don't want to be like that. I like being paid to do good things best. But if I have to bare my back to make a buck, just watch my shirt come off. Dane Allred's World of Hurt. Head over heels. In my junior year at Jordan High School, I trained myself to be a yell leader, a male cheerleader. We were supposed to do acrobatics and gymnastics, but I had never had any training, so I practiced by jumping off inner tubes. Trying to do backflips meant landing on my head several times. There never seemed to be any damage, except I felt the strange desire after that to write radio episodes. I've even fallen backward downstairs in front of an entire cast of one of my musicals. Backing up on the stage 1 foot too far, I tumbled backwards, doing a reverse somersault, and then quickly jumping to my feet and proclaiming, "I'm all right." Then we went back to rehearsing. Trying to combine both of these events into one disaster, I took the cast to the stage during an intermission of a Shakespeare production. One of my students did a backflip on the stage, and I confidently proclaimed, "I can do that." Taking off my glasses and removing my cell phone from my belt, don't want those things to get damaged, I ran and did my round off into a back handspring. Failing to gain much height and having little muscle tone anymore, my head made it all the way around from the floor to the floor. My face thumped first onto the stage, followed by my crumpling body. I'd actually hit my right cheekbone first, and in front of all the students, I slowly stood and put my hand to my cheek, which immediately began swelling up. I declared intermission's over, and we went back to the performance. I was running the lights and stopped on the way to buy a cold drink in an aluminum can. The swelling on my cheekbone was now the size of a golf ball, but rolling the cold aluminum can on the swollen flesh seemed to help. I left later that night looking like Quasimodo's brother. I've had other incidents at my high school which involve inflicting pain on others. I seem to have a charmed life when it comes to injuries, and so at times I'm not as careful as I should be. Scott was helping me in my technical theater class. We were trying to staple a side curtain up as a leg to block sight lines backstage. Upon the ladder, I was confidently stapling away, 17 feet off the ground, as most of the students have enough brains to be afraid of heights. I have even had my technical theater class raise me up the entire 40 feet to the top of the fly system so I could replace lights on the ceiling. I don't know what I would have done if they had decided not to let me back down. But on this day, Scott was attentively waiting for the stapler. I decided to toss it down to him so he could take it to the other side of the stage for use there. As Scott was looking up, I told him to get ready for the stapler. He was looking right at me, and so I tossed it down. This was a Stanley stapler, the solid metal kind, which must have reached terminal velocity by the time it reached him. He chose, at this particular moment, to be distracted by one of his classmates, and as he looked away at them, the stapler hit him right on top of his head and made a huge gash. I hurried down the ladder, and we went to the office and filed an accident report. I haven't thrown down a stapler since. Scott went off to the hospital to have stitches put in his head, and I resolved not to endanger any other students just because I seem to have a charmed existence. I am a danger to other people. I'm also dangerous to my own cars. Once, when I had a television repaired for $300, I plopped it down in the front seat and didn't think what would happen with a quick stop, which cracked the windshield, which added another $100 to the repair bill. When that same television went on the fritz again later, I drove it to the local charity and dumped it off. Imagine my surprise after I had bought a new television for several hundred dollars when I went to shop at the charity store and saw my old television back in working order and priced at only $100. It made me want to bash my windshield, but I had already learned that lesson. Learning is one of the greatest things about getting to live longer. I can't wait to find out what I will be blessed to learn next. This is Abundance. I am Dane Allred, your host. Today we're listening to an episode from My Adventures and Musings. We'll also hear today some selections from Literature Out Loud, including five sonnets by William Shakespeare. It's my great pleasure to spend this time with you and share the abundance I find in my life, with a hope you are also finding the abundance offered by this wonderful world in your life. Literature Out Loud, As I Walk These Broad Majestic Days, by Walt Whitman. As I walk these broad, majestic days of peace, for the war, the struggle of blood finished, wherein, oh, terrific ideal, against vast odds erewhile have gloriously won, now thou stridest on, yet perhaps in time toward denser wars, perhaps to engage in time in still more dreadful contests, dangers, longer campaigns and crises, labors beyond all others. Around me, I hear that éclat of the world, politics, produce, the announcements of recognized things, science, the approved growth of cities, and the spread of inventions. I see the ships. They will last a few years. The vast factories with their foremen and workmen, and hear the endorsement of it all, and do not object to it. But I, too, announce solid things. Science, ships, politics, cities, factories are not nothing. like a grand procession to music of distant bugles pouring, triumphantly moving and grander heaving in sight. They stand for realities. All is as it should be. Then my realities. What else is so real as mine? Libertad and the divine average, freedom to every slave on the face of the earth, the rapt promises and lumen of seers, the spiritual world, these century-lasting songs, and our visions, the visions of poets, the most solid announcements of any. The Imp and the Crust by Leo Tolstoy. A poor peasant set out early one morning to plow, taking with him for his breakfast a crust of bread. He got his plow ready, wrapped the bread in his coat, put it under a bush, and set to work. After a while, when his horse was tired and he was hungry, the peasant fixed the plow and let the horse loose to graze, and went to get his coat and his breakfast. He lifted the coat, but the bread was gone. He looked and looked, turned the coat over, shook it out, but the bread was gone. The peasant could not make this out at all. "That's strange," thought he. "I saw no one, but all the same, someone has been here and has taken the bread." It was an imp who had stolen the bread while the peasant was plowing, and at that moment he was sitting behind the bush, waiting to hear the peasant swear and call on the devil. The peasant was sorry to lose his breakfast, but "it can't be helped," said he. "After all, I shan't die of hunger. No doubt whoever took the bread needed it. May it do him good." And he went to the well, had a drink of water, and rested a bit. Then he caught his horse, harnessed it, and began plowing again. The imp was crestfallen at not having made the peasant sin, and he went to report what had happened to the devil, his master. He came to the devil and told how he had taken the peasant's bread, and how the peasant, instead of cursing, had said, "May it do him good." The devil was angry and replied, "If the man got the better of you, it was your own fault. You don't understand your business. If the peasants and their wives after them take to that sort of thing, it will be all up with us. The matter can't be left like that. Go back at once," said he, "and put things right. If in 3 years you don't get the better of that peasant, I'll have you ducked in holy water." The imp was frightened. He scampered back to her, thinking how he could redeem his fault. He thought and thought, and at last hit upon a good plan. He turned himself into a laboring man and went and took service with the poor peasant. The first year, he advised the peasant to sow corn in a marshy place. The peasant took his advice and sowed in the marsh. The year turned out a very dry one, and the crops of the other peasants were all scorched by the sun, but the poor peasant's corn grew thick and tall and full-eared. Not only had he grain enough to last him for the whole year, but he had much left over besides. The next year, the imp advised the peasant to sow on the hill. It turned out a wet summer. The people's corn was beaten down and rotted, and the ears did not fill, but the peasant's crop up on the hill was a fine one. He had more grain left over than before, so that he did not know what to do with it all. Then the imp showed the peasant how he could mash the grain and distill spirit from it. The peasant made strong drink and began to drink it himself and give it to his friends. So the imp went to the devil, his master, and boasted that he had made up for his failure. The devil said he would come and see for himself how the case stood. He came to the peasant's house and saw that the peasant had invited his well-to-do neighbors and was treating them to drink. His wife was offering the drink to the guests, and as she handed it round, she tumbled against the table and spilled a glassful. The peasant was angry and scolded his wife. "What do you mean, you slut? Do you think it's ditch water, you cripple, that you must go pouring good stuff like that over the floor?" The imp nudged the devil, his master, with his elbow. "See," said he, "that's the man who did not grudge his last crust." The peasant, still railing at his wife, began to carry the drink round himself. Just then a poor, returning from work, came in uninvited. He greeted the company, sat down, and saw that they were drinking. Tired with his day's work, he felt that he too would like a drop. He sat and sat, and his mouth kept watering, but the host, instead of offering him any, only muttered, "I can't find drink for everyone who comes along." This pleased the devil, but the imp chuckled and said, "Wait, wait a bit. There's more to come yet." The rich peasants drank, and their host drank too, and they began to make false, oily speeches to one another. The devil listened and praised the imp. "If," said he, "the drink makes them so foxy that they begin to cheat each other, they will soon all be in our hands." "Wait for what's coming," said the imp. "Let them have another glass all round. Now they are like foxes, wagging their tails and trying to get round one another. But presently you will see them like savage wolves." The peasants had another glass each, and their talk became wilder and rougher. Instead of oily speeches, they began to abuse and snarl at one another. Soon they took to fighting and punched one another's noses, and the host joined in the fight, and he too got well beaten. The devil looked on and was much pleased at all this. "This is first rate," said he. But the imp replied, "Wait a bit. The best is yet to come. Wait till they have had a third glass. Now they are raging like wolves, but let them have one more glass, and they will be like swine." The peasants had their third glass and became quite like brutes. They muttered and shouted, not knowing why, and not listening to one another. Then the party began to break up. Some went alone, some in twos and some in threes, all staggering down the street. The host went out to speed his guests, but he fell on his nose into a puddle, smeared himself from top to toe, and lay there grunting like a hog. This pleased the devil still more. "Well," said he, "you have hit on a first-rate drink, and have quite made up for your blunder about the bread. But now tell me how this drink is made. You must first have put in fox's blood. That was what made the peasants sly as foxes. Then I suppose you added wolf's blood. That is what made them fierce, like wolves. And you must have finished off with swine's blood to make them behave like swine." "No," said the imp, "that was not the way I did it. All I did was to see that the peasant had more corn than he needed. The blood of beasts is always in man, but as long as he has only enough corn for his needs, it is kept in bounds." While that was the case, the peasant did not grudge his last crust, but when he had corn left over, he looked for ways of getting pleasure out of it. And I showed him a pleasure, drinking, and when he began to turn God's good gifts into spirits for his own pleasure, the foxes, wolves, and swine's blood in him all came out. If only he goes on drinking, he will always be a beast. The devil praised the imp, forgave him for his former blunder, and advanced him to a post of high honor. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 31 by William Shakespeare. Thy bosom is endeared with all hearts, which I by lacking have supposed dead, and there reigns love, and all love's loving parts, and all those friends which I thought buried. How many a holy and obsequious tear hath dear religious love stolen from mine eye, as interest of the dead, which now appear but things removed that hidden in thee lie. Thou art the grave where buried love doth live, hung with the trophies of my lovers gone, who all their parts of me to thee did give. That due of many now is thine alone. Their images I loved, I view in thee, and thou, all they, hast all the all of me. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 32 by William Shakespeare. If thou survive my well-contented day, when that churl death my bones with dust shall cover, and shalt by fortune once more resurvey these poor rude lines of thy deceased lover, compare them with the bettering of the time, and though they be outstripped by every pen, reserve them for my love, not for their rhyme, exceeded by the height of happier men. Oh, then vouchsafe me but this loving thought, had my friend's muse grown with this growing age, a dearer birth than this his love had brought, to march in ranks of better equipage. But since he died, and poets better prove theirs for their style, I'll read his for his love. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 32 by William Shakespeare. Full many a glorious morning have I seen flatter the mountain tops with sovereign eye, kissing with golden face the meadows green, gilding pale streams with heavenly alchemy. Anon, permit the basest clouds to ride with ugly rack on his celestial face, and from the forlorn world his visage hide, stealing unseen to west with this disgrace. Even so my sun, one early morn did shine with all triumphant splendor on my brow, but out, alack, he was but 1 hour mine. The region cloud hath masked him from me now, yet him, for this my love no whit disdaineth. Suns of the world may stain when heaven's sun staineth. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 34 by William Shakespeare. Why didst thou promise such a beauteous day, and make me travel forth without my cloak, to let base clouds o'ertake me in my way, hiding thy bravery in their rotten smoke? 'Tis not enough that through the cloud thou break, to dry the rain on my storm-beaten face, for no man well of such a salve can speak, that heals the wound and cures not the disgrace. Nor can thy shame give physic to my grief, though thou repent. Yet I have still the loss. The offender's sorrow lends but weak relief to him that bears the strong offense's cross. Ah, but those tears are pearl which thy love sheds, and they are rich and ransom all ill deeds. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 35 by William Shakespeare. No more be grieved at that which thou hast done. Roses have thorns, and silver fountains mud, clouds and eclipses stain both moon and sun, and loathsome canker lives in sweetest bud. All men make faults, and even I in this, authorizing thy trespass with compare, myself corrupting, salving thy amiss, excusing thy sins more than thy sins are. For to thy sensual fault I bring incense, thy adverse party is thy advocate, and gainst myself a lawful plea commence. Such civil war is in my love and hate, that I, an accessory, needs must be to that sweet thief which sourly robs from me. Plotter's Mile, Chapter 12. As the sun was coming up, Raymond Johnson was looking for a good place to hide the car. But all there was in this part of the state was farms. He began looking for a dirt road to go down, and maybe he would be able to find some thick growth to hide the car in. On the left of the road, Ray saw a gap in the trees and just past the big red barn, he turned down the road. It wound around for quite a while, and Ray decided, after about half a mile, that he was far enough from the main road, and the thick trees here would hide the car, too. He pulled over and got out of the car and stretched. Ray had been driving for about 2 hours, and the way he figured, if he waited the rest of this day, cops wouldn't be looking as hard for Larry's car as they do right away. As he stretched, Ray decided it was time to admire his handiwork and grabbed the bundle from the back seat. Pulling off the wrapping, Ray admired the green bills. Then he cut through the twine that was holding the whole package together. He pulled off the first bill and saw the stack of paper underneath. He flipped down a few more. Paper. Pulling the stack in half, he tossed the paper to the ground, looking desperately for the money for which he had killed two people. At the bottom of the pile, he found 9 more bills. He counted the total take. Only $1,800. Ray kicked the side of the car, putting a huge dent in the door. He screamed out loud to no one in particular. He grabbed the paper which had surrounded the bundle and pulled it flat, searching for another $100 bill. It was then he saw the evidence sticker that was stuck to the bottom of the wrapper. John Graham, 130 Walnut, a phone number. It was a receipt for $1,800. Ray stared at the paper for over a minute, trying to turn over the possibilities. The police had pulled him in like a fish, but did the police have the money? It could be in a bank safe somewhere else, but then why would this guy's name be on it? They used the $1,800 to get him to come collect the bundle, probably hoping to catch him then. Well, the cop who thought that up was either dead or had a bullet hole in him. But what about this address? Slowly, Ray walked around the car, pushing the fake paper bills away from the car with his feet. The wind was blowing them down the dirt road. He took the $1,800 from his pocket and looked closely at them. The serial numbers were consecutive, but the rest of the money was missing. What did it mean? John Graham was at home thinking hard about the mess he had created for himself. A gangster was out there somewhere wondering where the rest of his money had gone. His best friend had been shot because John wanted to keep money he'd found on the railroad tracks. His wife kept asking him what was wrong. He decided to go jogging and think. "I'm sorry," John explained. "I think I'm just worried about Greg. I'll be back in just a bit." Then he was out the door. He began thinking about running his fourth marathon. He wished he was running a marathon right now. Then he would have 5 hours to think. 5 hours was a terrible time for most marathon runners, but John was proud just to be able to finish, even though the runners who won the race could have run the course twice in that amount of time. It really did give you a sense of accomplishment to finish 26.2 miles, even if you were plodding while you were doing it. When you hit the 18 and 19 mile markers, you weren't sure if you would make it. Even though the biggest part was behind you, the wall runners talk about hitting becomes a massive stone behemoth ready to fall across you. At that point in the race, you'd be happy for a wall of rock to fall on you. But the 20-mile mark was magic because you knew you only had 6.1 miles left. The difference between 6.1 and 7.1 miles might as well have been 10 miles instead of just one. Maybe he was just in the last mile before the ending was in sight. Would he give up the money now and regret not having gone that last mile? Just like when he was running a marathon, John thought to himself that most difficulties were overcome by mental toughness and not necessarily by sheer strength. John jogged across the railroad tracks again, thinking about how these tracks had started the problems he now found himself in. John dug in and decided he could have the mental toughness to finish what he had started. This wall he felt pressing up against him would be temporary, unless the real wall was hidden somewhere up ahead. Ray was a slow thinker, but he was methodical. It only took about an hour, and he thought he had figured out where the money was and what this guy named John Graham had done. Ray figured this guy had hid it somewhere, probably in his house, and was hoping the bank wouldn't figure it out. Maybe this guy hoped Ray would get caught, go to jail for the robbery, and the money would never be found. Ray clenched his fists at the thought of someone else spending the money while he rotted in jail. There was no way that was going to happen. And Ray had a pretty good idea how to get his money back. Then Ray noticed some motion further down the road. As a shape in the distance got closer, Ray could tell it was a man carrying a gun. It could be a hunter, or it could be the cops, but then why would one person be walking up without even a warning? Just to be safe, Ray hid the revolver in his coat pocket. "Howdy," the man in the overalls spoke first. "Hey," said Ray, "out hunting?" "Nah, just out shooting some old ammunition," said the old-timer, who looked to be over 70, to Ray. "Car trouble?" "Nah, just needed to stretch my legs for a while. I thought this road maybe led to a lake or something," said Ray, relaxing a bit. "Ah, there is a lake just around the corner of the fence," pointed the old geezer, using his gun to point and then waving it in Ray's direction. Ray tried hard not to flinch. "Thanks, I might drive down and check it out," said Ray. "Good fishing in the lake?" "Not bad," said the man. "Just be careful about the game warden. He don't like it when I catch too many fish." The old guy chuckled, and Ray got back into his car and said thanks again. Ray thought he might just camp out by the lake until tomorrow. Spending a night by the lake wouldn't be too bad, and by then the heat should be off. A gunshot made Ray jump in his seat. He looked back in the car mirror. A crow fluttered to the ground. The old guy walked over and kicked it with his foot. It was after 8:30 by the time Greg arrived back at Paula's. As he knocked slowly, he could hear her in the room straightening up, probably making him wait because he made her wait. Well, he was late. But when the door opened, Paula's face turned from irritation to concern. "What has happened to you?" "I've been shot." He wasn't sure she believed him, but then she looked from his arm up to his face and then back to his arm. She couldn't get him in the room and down on a chair fast enough. Ray sat quietly by the lake planning his revenge. He hoped there was a family in the picture because that always made getting what you wanted easier. Every once in a while, he heard the old farmer's rifle, and Ray pictured John Graham being shot by Larry's gun, being held in Ray's hand. Too bad he didn't have a picture to make the visualization complete. That would come later. "You mean you got shot because of my report?" Paula pushed Greg's good shoulder, which made him wince because his whole body moved. She was immediately repentant, saying, "Oh, I'm sorry, did that hurt your arm? I can't believe you almost got killed because of me." She was on the verge of tears. "Calm down, it's not your fault," said Greg. "Remember, I'm the one who made the phone call and asked you to do the story. We just didn't think this guy would be so serious about getting his money so soon."
"We?"
"Sorry," Greg apologized. "We mean Schmitty. Harold Smith, one of my old friends who is the state investigator. You've met him." Paula looked confused.
"But I thought you told me he didn't get his money, just a small part of it."
"Yeah, but he didn't know all the money wasn't there, and I purposely decided not to tell you. And you were smart enough not to ask," smiled Greg, wondering why of all the jerks in the world she had to settle on this jerk who had just admitted using her.
"Don't you ever ask me to put you in danger again," she warned. "I've spent far too much time trying to get to this point in my life without you dying on me."
She reinforced the point by gently sitting down next to him and laying her head on his chest.
"You need me around to take care of you, it looks like," she purred.
"And I sure as hell need you around to take care of me."
Literature Out Loud, Gunga Din, by Rudyard Kipling.
"You may talk of gin and beer when you're quartered safe out here and you're sent to penny fights in Aldershot it. But when it comes to slaughter, you will do your work on water and you'll lick the bloomin' boots of him that's got it. Now in India's sunny clime, where I used to spend me time, a servant of Her Majesty the Queen, of all them black-faced crew, the finest man I knew was our regimental beastie, Gunga Din. He was Din, 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 you limpin' lump of brick dust, Gunga Din. Hi, slippery hither-ay-o, water, get it, panny-lay-o, you squidgy-nosed old idol, Gunga Din. The uniform he wore was nothing much before, and rather less than half of that behind. For a piece of twisty rag and a goatskin water bag was all the field equipment he could find. When the sweating troop lay training a siding through the day, where the heat would make your bloomin' eyebrows crawl, we shouted, "Harry, bye," till our throats were bricky dry, and we whopped him because he couldn't serve us all. It was din, 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 you heathen, where the mischief have you been? You put some joldy in it, or I'll marrow you this minute if you don't fill up my helmet, Gunga Din. He would dot and carry one till the longest day was done, and he didn't seem to know the use of fear. If we charged or broke a cut, you could bet your bloomin' nut. He'd be waiting 50 paces, right flank rear. With his mussick on his back, he would skip with our attack and watch us till the bugles made retire. And for all his dirty-eyed, he was white, clear white inside. When he went to tend the wounded under fire, it was din, 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 with the bullets kicking dust spots on the green. When the cartridges ran out, you could hear the front files shout, "Hi, ammunition mules, and Gunga Din." I shan't forget the night when I dropped behind the fight with the bullet where my belt plate should have been. I was choking mad with thirst, and the man that spied me first was a good old grinning, grunting Gunga Din. He lifted up me head, and he plugged me where I bled, and he gave me half a pint of water green. It was crawling and it stunk, but of all the drinks I've drunk, I'm gratefulest to one from Gunga Din. It was din, 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 is a beggar with a bullet through his spleen. He's chawing up the ground and he's kicking all around. For God's sake, get the water, Gunga Din. He carried me away to where a dooley lay, and a bullet come and drilled the beggar clean. He put me safe inside, and just before he died, "I hope you like your drink," says Gunga Din. So, I'll meet him later on at the place where he's gone, where it's always double drill and no canteen. He'll be squatting on the coals, giving drink to poor damned souls, and I'll get a swig in hell from Gunga Din. Yes, Din, 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 you Lazarusian leather Gunga Din, though I've belted you and flayed you by the living God that made you. You're a better man than I am, Gunga Din.
Literature Out Loud, If, by Rudyard Kipling. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good nor talk too wise. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thought your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken, and stoop and build them up with worn-out tools. If you can make one heap of all your winnings, and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss, and lose, and start again at your beginnings, and never breathe a word about your loss. If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone, and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it, and which is more, you'll be a man, my son.
Anything you hear on Abundance is available anytime at DaneAllred.com or 1001 Thanks. Subscribe for $1 a month and keep the hundreds of selections available for everyone to enjoy. With more than 12,000 visitors from more than 50 countries, it amazes me how much we can share with each other as this world shrinks every day. I welcome new friends this week from Iran, China, Belgium, and Germany. Thank you for joining me for this episode of Abundance. Proclaim the abundance in your life today. Tell those you love, I love you. Contemplate your blessings and look in your life for those who need your helping hand. Keep the positive attitude of abundance, no matter the opposition from the world. And now I am grateful you and I have shared this time together.